Well, I don't. I actually don't want to say too much this afternoon, so as to leave enough time for the questions or reflections you may have, and some dialogue together. So rather than give the kind of what's become the sort of orthodoxy of these things of giving the Dharma talk, as it were, I just offer a few reflections around this, around the theme we've been looking at. And then let's see what we might explore together. And first, just to respond to the question this morning about the sense of gentle discipline, and the fact that mostly we know, you know, even when you hear, just see what associations you have when you hear the word discipline. The way we know a sense of discipline is as being driven by what we were calling this morning the tyranny of should. Discipline seems like something harsh. Actually, a lot of the associations with discipline are ones of punishment. And so it does need, right? If you're going to train in anything, whether it's learning a musical instrument or some academic study or a sport or meditation, training your mind, then it needs some discipline in that. And yet, when what we're training in is the art of allowing, the art of gentleness, the art of disengaging from the tendency to drive ourselves in a particular direction and be hard with ourselves, then, like the person was pointing out, that calls into question, how do I honour the sense of and the need for a kind of discipline? Something to actually support me in deepening this training of mind, in deepening this freeing of heart, in committing in the way that I recognise really makes a difference. Without that becoming something tight, without it being a chore, without it being discipline in the terms at least of something kind of harsh, and maybe even in terms of feeling like our practice is a punishment. And some of you will have heard me speak before about this kind of formula of 100% commitment plus 100% forgiveness. And of course there's a paradox in there, and yet I think it's an important or helpful one. Because if we only have one side, we get into trouble. If we only have the 100% commitment, that's the right. That's there's some rigidity and harshness to that. If we only have 100% forgiveness, then, you know, we might be wound up as one of those people who love meditation in theory. We might be somebody who endlessly tells everybody else how good meditation is and how good it would be for them. Somebody who values meditation greatly. In fact, all the elements of loving the practice are there except for actually doing it, because we're too busy forgiving ourselves. So that sense of feeling, the 100% commitment, you know, it's not because it's something that I should do, but that it's actually something born of the longing for freedom, the love of intimacy with life, and that deepening sense of infinite possibility for the ways we can come to know and explore and free up consciousness. It's a commitment born in a way of increasingly knowing and trusting the goodness of our practice. And when we look at Mara, and we use the kind of language today, harshness, measurement, comparison, in fact, a lot of ways we look at Dharma practice, what we do, it's a practice of shining the light on everything we notice that isn't free, of engaging our unfreeness, of working with our unfreeness. We don't need to work with our freeness. The freeness is free. Freeness doesn't need any work. Right? We work with our unfreeness, and in doing so, it's like it frees up. So because of that, if what we're doing in our practice is facing our unfreeness, our stuckness, our compulsions, our contractions, our confusions, in the rather naked way that we do, then if we're not careful, that can reinforce the sense, the feeling of being in some way wrong, broken, deficient, deluded, etc. And so that sense, and even the phrase, you know, to trust the goodness of your practice. I mean, just the fact that you're here today, the fact that there's some kind of the compass of your heart recognizes the value of this. Oh, there's a lot of goodness in that. So maybe rather than the word discipline, and you know, I know that different language basically has different associations for people, so I think one has to find one's own language. But maybe rather than the language of my practice or my morning meditation or whatever as a discipline, maybe just the sensing of it, or the reminding oneself of it as an alignment with goodness. I remember when a friend, actually Yanai, who teaches here often, when he first came back from a few years in India, and trying to find a way to field the questions of friends and family about what the hell he was doing with this funny meditation practice, and trying to explain, you know, some basics of Buddhist teachings or something, and not getting very far. And in the end, the description he settled on for explaining what it was all about is, he said it was happiness training. So, again, rather than the discipline of meditation practice, oh, just doing a little bit of happiness training. And a commitment born of that, and the willingness to forgive, to drop it, to leave it alone, when for whatever reason you don't live up to the internalized ideal. And let's face it, internalized ideals are more or less impossible to live up to. Right? When you don't live up to the internalized ideal for what you think that practice should look like, for how much you think you should be meditating, for how much progress, whatever that is, you think you should be making. So, who was it? There's some famous quote about failing and failing again, and failing better. You know that quote?
Beckett.
It's Beckett, right.
Yes,
yeah.
Learning to fail. Fail again, fail better.
Yeah. And Tibetan teacher Trungpa Rinpoche, when asked to define Dharma practice, is, well, I've heard it variously quoted as one failure after another, or and also one insult after another. And the way Mara gets hold of discipline, as well as the kind of maybe unconscious associations with harshness or punishment, are that, and there's a kind of perversity in this, but to the extent that we don't believe in or don't feel our goodness, right, the goodness of heart that's willing to do this kind of practice, the evolution of our consciousness that's there to the point that we recognize the value of this and the possibility of transforming our own hearts and minds in this way. To the extent that we don't see that, and that we dwell in a view of ourselves as somehow broken or deficient, it's like to that extent we try to compensate for that by establishing a version of our practice that's unrealistic, actually. So in other words, to say what I mean, to the extent that I feel somehow inadequate, and that I project that onto any area of my life, so Dharma practice, along with anything else, to that extent I try to get adequacy by saying, right, well, in that case, I'm going to meditate and I'm going to really be a good student and I'll reclaim my sense of adequacy through Dharma practice now. I haven't managed to get it through my work or through this or that or anything, so I'll get it through Dharma practice. And I'll meditate every morning. And then that every morning turns out to be something we've established in a harsh way, or and then it starts to feel like a punishment, right? Because I've got to do this and that already in my life, and now, oh my God, I've got to do meditation practice as well. So feel out, you know, take the time to feel out your relationship to the discipline of practice, or the discipline of anything else. And when I say to take time to feel it out, to feel out what's it like, the engine of that commitment? What does the discipline feel like? And to what might you need to change in order that bringing yourself to the cushion in the morning, for example, actually feels like, it's not just a reframe in the language, that it actually feels like you're sitting down to align yourself with the goodness of your practice. And it feels like you're sitting down to incline your attention in a happier, freer, more fluid, more immediate, more allowing direction. And one way to do that is to have a sense of a commitment to practice that's not overstretched, that's not too idealized. We spoke about the difference this morning between ideal and aspiration. If it's too idealized, if I tell myself that it would be good for me if I sat for an hour and a half every morning, then that's probably, for most people, I would guess that's just a setup for failure. So, and some of you will have heard me say this before, but better to set the bar low and then consistently make it. And thus engendering a sense of that alignment, a sense of that goodness, a sense of living those intentions, rather than to set the bar impressively or idealistically high and then consistently fail to make it. And thus engendering a sense of failure. So don't set the bar so low that you don't even notice it. No, it needs to be a little stretch. So it's like the middle way. I'm finding the middle bar. I would say that in the last 15 years or so of teaching Dharma, that, I mean, it's a kind of arbitrary percentage, of course, but really I would say at least half of all the work I do with students, at least half of all the painful contraction I see students caught in, at least half of the kind of accompanying and exploring and reassuring and directing people's attention towards what's happening is within the realms of Mara, or the inner critic. It's such a fundamental structure. I mean, like I was saying this morning, Mara appears to the Buddha all through his life, right? So something that seems to be actually innately fundamental to having a human psyche, to have that structure show up in some way. And because it's so fundamental, and that to a large extent we're kind of either completely oblivious to it, or we exist in some kind of conflicted relationship with it, where we're either scared that it's true and trying to kind of hide from and ignore it, or we're trying to kind of argue with it, rationalize it, put it away, persuade it that no, actually, but look, I'm not so bad after all, because, or we're trying to project it out there, blaming others as a way to make ourselves feel better, or whatever, all the exhausting amount of strategizing around it. It's on the one hand, it's one of the most important elements, I would say, of any kind of inner work we can do, recognizing that it is a fundamental structure, whether we call it inner critic or superego or Mara or whatever. Recognizing it, getting to know it, getting space from it, getting friendly with it, all the things I was saying earlier. And in addition to it being so much of a part of what I see Dharma students engaging with, it's also that if we don't really work with that structure, then all the rest of our inner work, actually, whatever insights we might have, whatever patterns we work with, whatever behaviors we learn to change in some way, they tend to get undermined. The capacity for those insights or understanding or changes to really stick tends to just get undermined or eroded by that structure. The kind of self-doubt creeps in. It's like when people have some very beautiful kind of expansive experience in meditation, something that reveals to them the goodness of their practice, the freeness of their heart, the fluidity of life. Beautiful. And yet how that easily over time gets undermined by the voice of self-doubt that starts to tell us, oh, well, actually you didn't, you know, you kind of made it up or something. Or what's the matter with you? You had that experience once. What's the matter with you that then you just went back into your usual confused state? Or whatever. You can fill in your own gaps. And just another kind of reflection I wanted to add to this is just how much, you know, Mara, in its broad strokes, is universal. Like I say, it's fundamental to having a human psyche. And yet, that for each one of us, it's also very personal. It's constructed of our own history. And it generally tends to feel uniquely awful. I mean, that kind of personal. Like worse than everybody else's. Like, I get it that everybody else has some issues with Mara, but you wouldn't believe this one's like. Right. When I was talking with Louise originally about doing a day long this year, and you know, usually the planning is about a year in advance. And the idea was to explore this theme today in the day long because of doing a week long here in London next month. And the idea that if we do the day long, that might produce some interest in the theme, and that therefore that could be explored in the week long. But it turns out we underestimated the interest in the theme, and the week long is already full with a long waiting list. So I'll probably do it again at some point. But in that kind of longer form exploration of this stuff, we'll go in much more into the history of Mara. And yeah, the way, I don't know, I'm kind of hesitating because I don't know how much I can say in such a short time, but the way that gets formed inevitably when we're young, by the ways in which we're somehow, we feel, whatever the good intentions and whatever the degree of care and parenting and education we got, whether it was really dysfunctional or whether it was really actually pretty functional or anywhere in between, nevertheless there's moments where we felt inevitably unattuned to, unmet, misunderstood, abandoned, criticized, bereft, etc. And those experiences impact us really strongly when we're young. And those of you who are kind of are studied or read or work professionally in psychology in some way or psychotherapy will be really familiar with this material anyway, right? And it's very helpful as you work with this structure to make room. There's a difference between, on the one hand, just getting caught up in the story. We know the story well, right? It's not about just endlessly replaying the story of what happened to me and what it was like for me, and whatever degree of blame and resentment is still left over towards parents, etc., etc., etc. It's this practice that we've been exploring together, and the way this practice is grounded in the contact with the immediacy of experience. And yet, this contact with immediacy, as we look at the nature of our tendency to be self-critical, judgmental, to give an attention that's also open to the associations and memories that inevitably arise with this stuff. Somebody was speaking this morning in the walking meditation of a childhood memory just arising unbidden, and in the making room for it, something kind of changing, evaporating, freeing. And that kind of, it's inevitable that some of that stuff arises. In fact, we may feel it's one of the clear clues that one's in the grip of the inner critic, that one tends to feel rather either some experience it just as small, and in terms of little, and some experience it more as young. And sometimes very helpful just to ask oneself, because it's sort of a shameful thing for us to feel young or small. We live in this world where everybody treats us as if we're an adult, and therefore we kind of feel like I ought to feel like an adult, right? Everybody else sort of seems to expect me to, and then I play along and I kind of relate to you as if I expect you to be an adult, etc. And there are parts of us that actually feel quite adult, parts of you that probably feel well developed and well grounded and well and capacitous. And there are parts of us that feel like they never made it, really, to adulthood. Maybe didn't even make it to adolescence. And so to be on the lookout in that way for the feeling of helplessness, lostness, impotence, those kind of feelings that go along with feeling young or small in the face of that structure. And as we investigate in that way, as we feel critical tendency, not just as its tone, well, that's part of it, the tone of harshness or the tone of nagging. Well, some of us, it's like an endless nag. The inner critic, what's the matter with you? Why can't you be more like them? Or the tone of a kind of cold, harsh, dismissive, just, you idiot. Right. Just a kind of, what's the word? That. Kind of disdain. Or for some of us, it's a tone more of a kind of blustery, self-righteous tone. Or for some of us, it's sort of passive-aggressive. Oh, yeah, well, I can see you're doing your best. So getting to know our own felt sense in the face of that structure, getting to know the tone in which the structure speaks to us, getting to know, for some of us, it's very clearly a voice. Right. Some of us, it's still the voice of one or other of our parents. and not necessarily because one or other parent was particularly critical, although it may be that too. But you know, our parents were. You know, Mara presents itself as the authority, as the truth. You should be like this. It should be like that. And you know, our parents were the godlike authority. Before we even had a concept of authority, right? They're just these all-providing, all-powerful beings in our life. And not to underestimate the power of that. And as I say, some of you who are kind of involved in psychology or psychotherapy in one way or another, this will be very familiar. But for others, I think there's sometimes a tendency within the framework of Eastern practices to sort of be a bit dismissive of Western psychological understanding. As if, oh, well, that's just in the realms of the self, and we're beyond self in this world, we're doing the spiritual. And yet, one doesn't get in any way, whatever we mean by beyond self, without understanding the mechanism of self, the way we get pinched in the stories and the history of self. So, that tends to be, you know, that tends to be to come clearer as we just attune to it over time. The tone, it's like getting to know Mara, how Mara is with you, how Mara speaks to you. Sometimes, for some, like I say, it's clearly a voice, maybe the voice of one or other parent or a teacher, or just a kind of general feel of an authority figure. If you've done a lot of this kind of practice, it might be some kind, it might appear in the voice of one of your teachers, or in the kind of caricature of a teacher, like some uptight, ferocious style teacher. For some, it's not so much a voice; it's more just an atmosphere of wrongness. And sometimes harder to get a handle on initially. Because I can't identify it as a voice, but it's just a feeling of, oh no! A feeling of being wrong. A feeling of that I shouldn't be like this, or a feeling that I shouldn't be here. Or sometimes just a feeling that I shouldn't be. So it's not very glamorous spiritual work. It's often quite confronting and quite stark kind of work. And as well as it coming clearer over time, as we get used to just recognizing, you know, that I see you, Mara, knowing judgment as judgment, knowing doubt as doubt, knowing comparison as comparison, rather than getting into the content. The content is all about how I ought to be different, etc. So when, as you get more familiar, as you get more skilled with recognizing the content isn't so important as just recognizing that that's what's in place. Oh, judging. Oh, comparing. Or in other words, in the language of the tradition, oh, I see you, Mara. And partly, as I say, as we get to see it more, we get more familiar with the tone, or the voice, or the atmosphere of it. And partly, I would say, we can't rely on meditation practice for that. We can't rely just on meditation practice for that, because Mara really arises relationally. Where I really get into comparing and measuring and judging is with you, whoever the you is. And there's a certain amount of, you know, work you can do with that in just your normal relational life. Just noticing how you kind of posture yourself inwardly in regard to colleagues and friends. And siblings, and lovers, and partners, etc., etc. And partly your those you have contact with in an environment like this, those that share a certain these same sensibilities, is a really great resource. I really encourage you, and I know it's not easy, and in a little day like this, there's not much of a chance to establish a context for that. But the opportunity to actually explore with others, it's very relieving to see that actually it's not just my own crazy mind that gives me a hard time. To actually really get it, that it's a fundamental part of having a human psyche. That it's not, that the presence of Mara itself isn't something wrong about me. So it's something that I can just actually learn to take less personally, less seriously, less authoritatively. So I was wondering, given that lack of context, I was just wondering about spending a few minutes sharing your own, maybe we'll do that just briefly. So what we'll do, if we just, in a moment, let me explain first, we'll just turn to someone near you, and we'll just spend a few minutes telling each other, what do you know about Mara? What do you know about your own inner critic? What do you know about how she or he shows up? About the kind of voice or tone she or he has, about who she or he might be channeling, you know, whether it's mother or father or some composite figure. And rather than just telling whatever you might already know, or making something up to fill the space if you feel like you don't know, just something we can sometimes do in these kind of contexts, see if you can just go slow. And you might get the most clues about how Mara shows up by just really attuning to your experience in the moment of having the contact and conversation with someone else. In the feeling that might arise, oh my goodness, what am I going to say? What will they think of me? Oh, hello, whose voice is that? Right? So you might just let the exploration, just for the few minutes that we have, be as real time as possible. And if that means you just stop as you're speaking and say, oh, I can feel now the way in which I'm sort of braced as I speak, as if there's a way in which I've got to do this right. Oh, right, it's a clue. I recognise that feeling of that. Oh, I can see how my shoulders are tense. Oh,